So Phineas Wake was published in 1939. It was James Joyce's
final. It was a dark day in Dallas.
Yes, and it was James Joyce's final production. He died 2 years later in January 1941. Okay, so the procedure is that Ion picks a page. Oh, let me see, what else could I say about the book? The book was started right after Ulysses was published in 1922, and that slowly made James Joyce considered to be the greatest writer of the 20th century up to that point. So Ulysses established his reputation, but he very quickly, within 2 years, 1924, he started to get published in a literary journal, the beginnings of his next work. And he didn't give it a title, he just called it Work in Progress. When it started to be seen in 1924, everybody thought James Joyce had gone nuts, and it didn't do well for his reputation. But he ignored that, and he published periodically, once or twice a year, for the next few years, actually up till 1938, so 16 years, he published excerpts of Work in Progress, and it just made his reputation worse, because nobody knew what the heck he was doing, and he couldn't even read it. A simple way to understand Phineas Wake, there's about 60 languages on each page, so it's literally unreadable. So why was James Joyce doing this? That's what we hope to find out here. So finally, the book was, all the excerpts in the various literary journals were cobbled together and released in 1939. And that's when people found out the title, Finnegan's Wake. And it's F-I-N-N-E-G-A-N, not apostrophe S, just S, no apostrophe, Finnegan's Wake. So it looked like it was a misspelling. And Finnegan's Wake is referring to a song, the famous Irish-American ballad that was popular in the day, about Tim Finnegan. And so I think the song was called Finnegan's Wake. So the book is referring to a song. Now, let's just tell you something. And this is when radio first started to take over. Well, it was taking over in the 20s and 30s, and that's when he was publishing excerpts from Work in Progress. So I will ask Ion to give us a page that they would like to begin on. Oh, yeah, so we should say there's 628 pages. There's an order to it in general. It's made up of three books, and the fourth book doesn't end, but it goes back, the last sentence goes back into the first book. So the fourth book becomes the first book again. And there are, there's 8 chapters in book 1, 4 chapters in book 2, 4 chapters in book 3, and 1 chapter in book 4, which is really part of book 1. So that's 16 chapters, sort of 17. Ulysses had 17 chapters. Phineas Wake almost gets 17 chapters, but actually the 17th is actually part of chapter 1. So, okay, Ion, what page should we start with?
That's easy, 44.
Okay, so we're going to do 44, and I'm going to read what I see, and I've got a book called Annotations of Phineas Wake, which is done by the famous Joyce scholar Roland McHugh. The first edition came out in 1980, but he had been hanging out with the various early James Joyce cabals, people reading in groups, and early scholars would publish in little magazines what they thought was going on in the wake. So after 20 years, say, Roland McHugh gathered together, I like to say, the top three interpretations of each line. So he released that in 1980, and then he's done subsequent editions through the last 40 years with more and more annotations. revealed. So what's useful is these guys figured out what the semantic meaning and what the words could refer to. But if you have read McLuhan and his different view of Finnegan's Wake, you have another way to look at what's going on that none of the other Joyce scholars had figured out. So when I read through Finnegan's Wake in 1985, it took me 2 years, I would read The Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake, read a couple of pages of it. That was put up by Joseph Campbell in 1944, the famous hero's journey guy. Joseph Campbell was a Finnegan, a Joycean scholar, and perhaps his whole idea of the Gnostic quest of the hero was his translation of what he thought was going on in Finnegan's Wake. So I would have a page or two of The Skeleton Key, his simplification of what he thought was going on each page of Finnegan's Wake, and Roland McHugh's annotations and Eric McLuhan's PhD, and guided by his father, Marshall McLuhan. So I would look at the three lenses of each page of Finnegan's Wake as I did it. And I think I only did one or two pages a night, and it took me two and a half years or so. Okay, so we go to page 44. Now, 44 is a favorite number of mine once we got into the 20th century, because we lived on City Island. We moved to City Island in August 2000, and we moved to 44 Fordham Street. Fordham was the university nearby, a Catholic university, where I gave my McLuhan doc 2 years earlier in 1998. We were living on the east side, 91st Street, east side, New York in that period. Fordham Street, 44. Now, I had decided that the 2000 period on would be rotating around the number 8. The 80s rotated around 22, the 90s rotated around 14, based on my experience, because we were living in Toronto in the 80s, so that's 2-run-2. There's your 22 right there in the word Toronto. We moved to New York, particularly the Manhattan Island, and that's about 14 miles long. And I had noticed that 14 started to dominate in the news more than 22. But for some reason, I decided that 8 took over in the 2000. I don't know when I decided that. It might have been because we moved to 44 in August 2000. So 8 is on its side is a Mobius strip or infinity sign. So I find it very appropriate for me in my mythology that we start at 44. Now, on this page is a song, the bottom part of the page, called The Ballad of Paris O'Reilly. So what's unique about this page is that it's prose that turns into a song. And there's three pages, three and a half pages of the song. The bottom third of 44, and then 45 is all song, 46 and 47 is all song. And then that's the end of chapter 2, which started on page 30. Okay, so I'm going to read it. I'll read it slowly. Yeah, I posted. You look on the chat, you'll see text. Let's see if anybody can say they found it. And if anybody finds a better text than what I'm posting, like Roy posted page 44. Well, that's good. Let's see. This is great. I bought the book, says Leah. Let's see, where did I start? Okay, so you got the text. My post and Roy posts something about Trump. Or maybe the picture you're talking about that kind of looked at. Then Leah says, this is great, I bought the book. Heather asks, is this the song? Let's see. Tim Finnegan's Wake with the lyrics. Looks like it is. Yes, the Clancy Brothers and the Dubliners apparently sing this. And is it starting? Why doesn't it go? Go. Doesn't move. I don't know why it's that. Oh, I guess we're listening to it, but it's not showing any of the lyrics. Oh, it's audience applause. That's probably what.
From a lather and broke his skull. And they had a wake for him, and at this wake there was lots of ishkabah, or water of life. There was also lots of fighting, drinking, dancing.
Everything. Are they going to sing it? Yep, that's it. You got the right one, Heather.
You got the right one, that's it.
Echoes are appropriate. There's a lot of echoing in Finnegan's Wake. So that's the song. And then Roxy writes, my classmates write and listen to music with no grammar, mixing languages. So these are people in their late teens, early 20s. Back to Babylon is the 70th week. Roxy was telling me the other day about the 70th week ion. Do you know about the 70th week as a phenomenon coming around Daniel or something? You know about that?
Yeah, the feast of weeks.
Okay. So she cites that. And then Skip says, the English old establishment tried to forbid the Irish from learning and literacy. It didn't work. No, Did the Irish become literate? I don't think so. As a matter of fact.
Maybe they wanted. Maybe they just wanted to.
Right. And Finnegan's Wake is, in a small subplot level, is Joyce's revenge against the English domination or the English takeover through the printed book. So he made a super crazy oral book. He retrieved the Irish tradition and hyped it up 1,000,000%. Then somebody named C.F. Apollyon, well, we remember him from years ago. He says, howdy. Roy gives us page 44. That's good. And Heather says the word water of life. She might have been quoting the song, but that's the whiskey, apparently the water of life. So we start off with the water of life, our theme. Just a question. In Sheila's painting, are the streams coming out of the rock with the trump head on it, are they the original living water streams, Ion, or the dead streams?
No, those were the rivers. The rivers that disappeared.
They went into the sand,
the Tigris and the Euphrates.
Yes, okay, so that's the living water. Okay, so I will, Ion, I'll just start reading it. You interrupt anytime you want to illustrate or say something.
That's a damn lie. Interrupt anytime we want to. Yeah, good luck with that.
No, I'll be listening. I'm a good listener. I'll welcome your interruptions. So, it starts off a few lines at the end of 43. I mean, this is just one long sentence. Page 42 in the middle it starts off, and then it goes two and a half pages, or maybe total 2 pages, and then it gets to the song. So they're going along, saying stuff, and they go near the bottom of page 43. To the added strains, so peaceful, of His Majesty the flute, that one croon king of inscruments, Pigot's purist, Cielo Absoluto, which Mr. DeLacy, horn, anticipating a perfect downpour of plaudits among the rhapsods. Now that's interesting. Personally, I'm anticipating much downpour of praise for the rhapsodies of me doing this Finnegan's Wake project with you will be bestowed on me. So there it is, the first sentence. Bob, anticipating a perfect downpour of plaudits among the rhapsodes. Roxy accuses me and Ion of being rhapsode poets. The horn piped out of his decent sort hat. It's funny, a decent sort hat, looking still more like his Percival namesake. Now that's a pun on Percival, and we're coming up to the Battle of Perce O'Reilly. So, still looking more like his Percival namesake, as men of Gaul noted, but before up to spewed about, the snowy crest curl amoist the leader's wild and molting hair, Dr. Hitchcock. Ooh, Peggy Hitchcock coming in this real early. Dr. Hitchcock, now we've become page 44, so we're into the area that Ion wanted to point out. Dr. Hitchcock hoisted his fezzy fuzz at bludgeon's height, signum to his companions of the chalice for the loud fellow. They have a secret society implied there. Boys and silentium in curia, in brackets, our maypole once more where he rose of old, end of bracket. And the canto, remember Ezra Pound was writing the cantos in this period. And the canto was chanted or chanted there, chorused and christened, whereby the old toll gate, St. Annona Street and Church. Now, Ian, what is, granted this is in the middle of a long sentence, what is the point or what is Joyce showing in this section that I just read? Do you have a comment on that?
You're not going to get it like that. You want this thing that James Joyce couldn't explain? You want us to explain what he couldn't even explain? That's rich. So
okay, so I'll do it this way. I'll do it this way. I will start citing the annotations, which gives us clues. So we have on, gives the page lines, so
but
I started reading it. What?
The opinions are wrong, but we'll listen.
I know, that's what we, that gives you something to correct you. That's all you can do is correct.
We really should be doing more show prep, Bob. We don't do enough.
No, you don't. Come on. Stop speaking of your limitations. Look at that. Sitting is ready, reducing Ion, who was arguing for his limitations. Now, Ion did say there's only two books worth reading, the Bible and Finnegan's Wake, and they're like bookends for the history of the Gutenberg galaxy. You begin with the Bible in 1500 or 1450, or Ion says it's actually a couple hundred years before that, and we end with the last book, Finnegan's Wake, which summarizes the whole history of literature and every other medium that he could think of. So, line 36, 35, 34, 33, 32, 31, 32, 34, yeah. Line 31, to the added strains. Wow, it starts with Scotia Minor, old name for Scotland. It starts with Nova Scotia, Carolyn. Scotia Picta, which is actually the line just above it. That's Picto, Nova Scotia. Well, that's very nice. Beginning with New Scotland, and then Wagner is in the word Parsifal. So Parsifal was a opera by Wagner, which is in the first line to the added strains, so peaceful. So somebody decided that it echoed Parsifal by Wagner, and there's a lot of opera in the book. Also, Percival is referenced, and that's a horn used in fox hunting, and we see two lines down the word horn. Then it talks about Parnell, who was a leader in Ireland who got scandalized out of office, but he was the people's love. Parnell is the uncrowned king of Ireland. Then it mentions Pigott's forgery of letters incriminating Parnell. They set Parnell up, the establishment. This is like in the 1880s or so. And Cielo Absolutio actually is Italian for sky. Now, instead of me, I don't know, reading every little note, we'll go over to page 44. Snowy Crested Curl, Roland McHugh's annotation suggests the song, The Snowy Breasted Pearl. The molting hare was the mountain hare. Ductor was leader. We come back to another reference to Parsifal, in the words, Fezzy Fuds at Bludgeon's Height, Elevation of Host and Ritual of Chalice in Parsifal. Remember that? Said the Secret Society down on line 3 of page 44, his companion of the chalice,
yeah,
for the Lord, for the loud fellow.
Longfellow. The chalice for
Longfellow, right.
But it's Lord fellow.
Right, no, that's good, because Longfellow is a famous British poet of the 19th century, and he's not mentioned. You come up with an original addition to the notes there, unless it's in a later book. Hitchcock, I'm suggesting Alfred Hitchcock, but he actually wasn't that well known in the 30s, so I don't think that's good.
No. Hitchcock is what they were trying to do. It's like a chicken towing a wagon. Hitch your dream to a chicken.
Now, isn't that a joke to imagine something being pulled by a chicken?
Especially if the ductor or the leader is doing it.
Right, and it's actually referring to Tommy Robinson, a 19th century Dublin organist. And he apparently has something to do with Knights of the Grail. Remember I was saying there was a secret society.
He had, Bob, he had a really big organ.
Yeah. Okay. And then, our maypole once more where he rose of old and the canto was chanted there, chorused and christened. The annotations have the word chase in here, but I don't see where that is, unless it's chalice or, chanted, chorused, christened. I don't see where chase is. And that's reference to a singer. And then the Latin phrase silentium in curia means silence in court. Okay, so we've got to the point where there's silence in a court. You want to add something, Ian? Tell us a bit about why would you pick this page? Have we said enough about it to indicate why you're talking about, why you indicate this is a beginning point?
You'll see.
Oh, okay.
Once you get around the maypole, you'll be all right.
Yeah, maypole's mentioned on line 4. Okay, so it says the next paragraph on 44, and around the lawn the ran it ran, and this is the ran that Hussey made. So the ran refers to a song. It's called in Ireland, in Irish, a verse. And so in German, ran also means flowed. So around the lawn, the verse, it flowed, and this is the ran that Hussey made. Hussey is the guy who writes the song, The Ballad of Percy Riley. So it says, boils and kales, scarrets and pritchards, versified and piercified, may the truth we tale of live in stony. Here line the refrains of, some vote him Vike, some mote him Mike, some dub him Lynn and Finn, while others hail him Lug, Bug, Danlop, Lex, Lax, Gun, or Gwyn. Some apt him Arth, some bapt him Barth, call, Nall, Saul, Will, Wheel, Wall. But I parse him, so the singer, or who is the narrator here, we're not sure, but I parse him Percy O'Reilly, else he's called no name at all. But he has many other names. Together, hurrah, leave it to Hosty, Frosty, Hosty, leave it to Hosty, for he's the man to rhyme the ran, the ran, the ran, the king of all rands. Now, is that a bird? Let's see. Boys and girls, Kaylee's girl, D.W. Cahill, Irish author, 6'5", feet, tall man, 6'5", died in Boston, skirts and breeches, and the pair of tree and stone, which becomes Tristan, of the Tristan and Iseult medieval fable. And then the word story comes in line 10. We tale of live in stony, but it can be in story. So here's Hossie explaining why he named it Percy O'Reilly. He's the man who wrote the ran. Then, have you here? Now, you have to look at that have you here as someone else speaking. So now we start to notice that there are many other voices going on in each page. And you might look at this as a pub. So somebody wants to start singing in the pub. And they are interrupted or prompted or argued against. So it says, have you here? And some laugh, some ha. Have we where? Some hint. Have you heard? Others do. Have we weird? So he's describing the audience response to these different proposals. Have we weird? Others don't. Then it says, it's coming, but it's spelled like the sexual thing, C-U-M. It's coming, it's brumming, the clip, the clop, glass crash. So a beer glass or something in glass crashes, and then it says the, and what's the noun that the article, the is an article before noun, it's a 100-lettered word, ending in exclamation mark. And it says clicka, clacka, cackles, cackle, I'll do that again, clicka, clacka, cackles, cats, oh, pats, clatch, bada, creppy, crotty, gridag, semi, ham, nuit, the, plotty, platty, pecan, pecat. So that's, turns out it's supposed to be maybe a thunder. And there's 10 of these in the first half of the book. And this is the second thunder. There was a Thunder on the first page. Actually, they call it the page three is where it begins. So you have this thunder, which can mean many things, and then underneath it, it says, Arditi. Arditi. And then underneath, there seems to be a line there, but it's only half a bracket. It says, music cue. So where is Arditi? Here's a thing about the wren, the ran, the ran. Irish children used to take a wren from door to door collecting money on St. Stephen's Day. They chanted, the wren, the king of all birds. Wren, pronounced like ran. Have you heard of the wren? So I have a note here, St. Stephen and Freemasons and Christ. So St. Stephen has something to do with the Freemasons. Now, the coming refers to the American poet E.E. Cummings on one level. Brumman refers to Buzz. So we've got coming. So then in French, in the word clacka clacka, it can be clack, which means to clap. So this is an applause happening before the song or at the same time as the song. Klatsch in German means clap. Batter in Italian means clap. So this 100-letter word, big chunk of it is made up of the word clap in different languages. The French was clack. And then you have a glass crashing. That's a theatrical sound effect. Russian klopat means clap. Irish grida means clapping. Okay, so if you want to think it's just clapping, it's obvious with all the words for clap from different languages. Oh, yeah, now here we come to Arditi. That refers to Senior Arditi, a conductor in 19th century Dublin, and he was nicknamed Nelson's Pillar. Nelson was a British admiral who did well for the British in, around the time of Napoleon or just after, or just before, no, during the time of Napoleon. Arditi also means to dare. Auditi is Italian, means to listen, but in Italian it also means to dare. So there's a dare, a challenge to get Hosty to sing. Then it says in theater, the music cue. Music cue means note on prompt copy of play indicating music. So